Let's say you've listened to my last few episodes. You've heard the horrifying damage that plastic pollution causes to our environment and animals, but you think, well, that's terrible, but I don't really care because it doesn't affect me. The truth is, it does affect you, indirectly and directly. You are eating microplastics and chemicals that come with them. So what are microplastics and what are their effects? Hi, my name is Mira Schroff and I'm an intern at Bethesda Green. I'm producing this podcast as my spring conservation project, which is a part of Bethesda Green's Environmental Leader Program. Thank you to the Chesapeake Bay Trust for making this podcast possible. Let's talk about what microplastics are. Microplastics don't have a universally agreed upon definition, but most people think of them as tiny plastic particles between 1 micrometer and 5 millimeters. For reference, some bacteria are 1 micrometer, the diameter of a strand of hair is about 50 to 70 micrometers, and the diameter of an eraser is about 5 millimeters. To explain the complicated topic of microplastics, I invited environmental toxicologist Dr. Jessie Myler to speak about microplastics. Thank you to her for joining me today.
Thank you to Dr. Myler for joining us today. Dr. Myler, if you'd like to introduce yourself, feel free to say anything related to your background or whatever you're working on.
Great. Well, thank you so much for having me, Mira. I'm happy to be here. My name is Jessie Myler, and I'm an environmental toxicologist at American University in Washington, D.C., and I study microplastics. I work with a bunch of different groups around D.C. also on microplastics work that they're doing, a lot of education and outreach initiatives too with local organizations. Some of the projects that I'm working on involve looking at microplastics in local waterways and tributaries to the Chesapeake Bay, including the Potomac and the Anacostia Rivers around DC, and also the Patapsco River in Baltimore. So I'm looking at microplastics in water and in sediment in those waterways. And I'm also looking at microplastics in biofilm communities with some colleagues from Maryland Sea Grant.
My next question is, how are microplastics formed?
So there, we kind of classify microplastics in lots of different ways. Most of the time we're talking about them according to size, right? There's two main classifications for how microplastics end up in an environment, and that's primary microplastics or secondary microplastics. The primary microplastics are things that are actually manufactured to be microplastics, right? Things like microbeads that are added to face wash, cosmetics, cleaners, abrasive cleaners, those kinds of things. Or they could also be the little pellets or the nurdles that are created that are then used for manufacturing larger plastics, right? Secondary microplastics are those plastics that actually start out as something larger that breaks up and it degrades in the natural environment. It can degrade into due to photochemical reactions where it breaks up in the sunlight into smaller pieces. There can be chemical reactions where there's chemical interactions with the plastic that cause it to break up into smaller pieces. Could be physical reaction, where you have the plastic that's kind of like getting beaten into the rocks and things or waves, right? It's moving with the waves or the current and it breaks up over time. And so those, the plastic itself gets broken up into smaller and smaller pieces over time, but it doesn't, I don't use the word break down because it does, that implies that it goes away, but break up into smaller pieces means that it is going to be smaller and smaller and smaller till we get to the nano size. We have really tiny little pieces of plastic in the environment, but they're not, it's not going away.
One type of primary microplastics are nurdles. We discussed nurdles in the first episode, but if you don't remember what they are, I'll review it. In the plastic production process, plastic is originally made into a powder. Then the plastic is made into nurdles, which are tiny, often clear beads. The beads are transported to factories, where they're melted and molded into the plastics we see today. And if you want more details, check out the first episode. Nurdles need to be transported from one place to another during the production process. Nurdles will spill out while being transported, whether they're on a truck, on land, or in a boat at sea. Nurdles are extremely light and can easily be blown around by the wind. After it rains, water can carry nurdles down storm drains and into bodies of water because nurdles float. Their small size means that they can take advantage of small holes in transportation containers. It's hard to tell if a few nurdles slipped out and then cleaned them up after. Nurdlehunt.org estimates that globally, 230,000 tons of nurdles enter our oceans every year. That's billions of nurdles. Because nurdles are so small and often clear, they imitate fish eggs, causing animals to mistakenly eat them. As Dr. Myler mentioned, microplastics such as nurdles also can further break down, and as they get smaller, even smaller organisms can eat them.
For other organisms, what we do know is that they are being taken up by lots of organisms, especially in the aquatic and marine environments. More has been done in ocean ecosystems and marine environments than in freshwater or aquatic systems. But more is being done, and that's largely what I'm working on too. It's trying to figure out the short-term and the long-term effects of microplastics, because we do know that organisms are interacting with microplastics, and the extent that they're having effects on the organisms can range from, some organisms that take them up because they are ingesting them and they get confused as food sources. And so they get taken up and they go through their digestive system. Sometimes they can actually have trouble moving through the digestive system and they kind of get caught up in there, and they can affect the long-term survival and even the ability to reproduce of the organisms, because it decreases their capacity to do certain things, right? So if their body starts to build up a fair amount of microplastics, it's going to be harder to actually eat more food, because that food doesn't have a whole lot of room to actually move through their system. There can be blockages within their digestive tract, their gastrointestinal tract. And so it can cause a lack of nutrient uptake, a lack of calories that they need for energy to actually survive, to escape predators, to reproduce, all of those other components of being able to survive as a species, right? And so there are some types of organisms that we're seeing greater effects in. And a lot of the work in the beginning started to be looking at macroplastics, so larger types of plastics in the environment that have been found in marine mammals and in some ocean-going birds like albatross and things like that. And we're seeing the similar types of effects in smaller organisms too. And so the blocking of the digestive tract and longer term issues that that animals are experiencing. There have been a number of studies that have looked at marine mammals and the long-term effects of microplastics, but at the same time, these are things that when we're looking at chronic effects, this takes a long time to actually study, and it's hard to actually replicate what's going on in the environment, especially with organisms that are bigger organisms, right?
There's a lot of uncertainty related to microplastics, which I'll get into more later. However, we do know that microplastics are everywhere.
How widespread or significant of a problem do you think microplastics are?
Well, what we do know is that microplastics are now pretty ubiquitous in the environment. That means that we see them and find them in almost all places that we look. So that can be, I mentioned that I look in our waterways, but it also can be potentially in our drinking water, in bottled water, in many foods that we eat as well. Microplastics have been found on the top of really remote mountaintops and in the furthest reaches of land that we can get to. So really, really remote places has led to a lot of studies that have started to look at how microplastics get there. And so what we do know is that they can travel in the air. And so a lot of the recent work has been looking at the transport and the fate of where they end up. So how they get there and where they end up in the end. And some of that is looking at existing models that we know, like looking at what we do know about air pollution and particulates that travel in the air, and they can travel really long distances. And some microplastics are really super tiny, so they can actually travel really far distances as well.
Numerous studies have confirmed that we eat, inhale and absorb microplastics. In one study, 0.44 microplastics per gram were found in sugar, 0.11 microplastics per gram were found in salt, 0.03 microplastics per gram were found in alcohol, and 0.09 microplastics per gram were found in bottled water. Researchers estimated that humans may eat 80 grams of microplastics per day. However, the human excretory systems should remove up to 90% of microplastics. Scientists estimate that a very small amount, about 0.3%, are actually taken up by the body. Another method by which microplastics enter our body is when we breathe them in. In one study, the authors found that the amount of microplastics that went into somebody's body while inhaling household dust were higher than the amount of microplastics that went into somebody's body while eating mussels. According to the research done at Utah State University, an average of 4% of atmospheric dust comes from plastic. Assistant Professor Janice Brawny said that that percentage is huge in an article by Chesapeake Quarterly. Inhaling microplastics could lead to respiratory issues, which are breathing issues, cytotoxic, which is toxic to cells, and inflammatory effects, and autoimmune diseases. One big risk relating to consuming microplastics comes from the chemicals that plastics include or carry. Microplastics can have two types of chemicals, ones added during the process of making the plastic, and the ones that plastic has adsorbed from the environment. One word that Dr. Myler uses is adsorption. This isn't the same as absorption. Adsorption is when something adheres or sticks to a different surface.
Why should we be concerned about microplastics? Or should we be concerned?
So that's still, I guess it depends on who you're talking about and what part of, I guess, the environment or an ecosystem you're thinking about, like concern-wise. I'll start by saying for humans, we're still learning. And so we're not really sure the level of concern that we should have with microplastics. But what we do know so far is that we are inhaling microplastics and we are ingesting microplastics through the food we eat and the water that we drink, other substances that we drink too. And so we do know that we're taking them in and we know that they're small enough to be inhaled and taken in through respiration and can end up in our body that way. Some of the things that we don't know is what happens once they get in the body. We do know that they're going through our body. They've been found in the feces, and we know that they move through the body. But while they're in the body, there's a number of studies that are looking at what happens while they're in there. Some of this right now is looking into like inflammation and whether or not microplastics can cross certain barriers, what happens when they're inside the body. And so there's been comparison to some types of particles that that do enter the body that are not necessarily microplastics, but they're comparing them to those kinds of particles because they're similar in size and they might be similar in nature is how they move through the body. The linkage between what you know, some of the organisms that are taking up microplastics and then us potentially eating them as humans, or the whether or not there's any sort of biomagnification that can happen for the organisms at the top of the food chain that might be taking in the, taking in those microplastics that are eating the organisms on the lower down on the food chain. And that actually touches on some issues that I'm interested in also, where, you know, plastics actually have a number of additives, or some plastics have additives that are used in the manufacturing process to add to the plastics to make them, you know, to add certain qualities and characteristics to the plastic, make them more durable, make them more flexible, or stiffer, right? Like, and so there's different things that can be added to the plastics. Some of those additives actually have known toxicity associated with them. And so just the additives themselves can actually pose problems for the organisms when they take them up, including humans. And so some of those issues, I think, are they're a really great interest, because those are the things that, it's not just the physical nature of the microplastics moving through an organism, but it's actually the chemical nature and potential toxicity of the chemicals that are associated with those plastics. There are certain types of contaminants, especially those that have an affiliation for, that are lipophilic. That means that they like fats, and they're actually able to adsorb or kind of stick onto some plastics as they're moving through the environment. And the thing about plastics is, as they break up into smaller and smaller pieces, you're actually getting more and more surface area. That means that there's like more places for things to glom onto, to stick onto them. And that goes for some of the chemicals that are in the environment, some pollutants and contaminants that are already out there, maybe some pesticides, maybe some PCBs, other things that are already in the environment, but they can kind of hitch a ride on the microplastics and travel through the environment on the microplastics. And when that happens, whatever is taking up those plastics is actually going to be exposed to those contaminants as well, potentially. And so there is that that potential risk or concern associated with the uptake of some of these contaminants that are kind of along for the ride on the plastics.
One thing that Dr. Myler mentioned was bioaccumulation, and another relevant concept to microplastics is biomagnification. Bioaccumulation is when one organism, such as a human, ingests a substance, for instance microplastics, faster than their body can get rid of it. This leads to more and more of the substance in their body over time. Biomagnification is a little more complicated and involves more organisms. When an organism low on the food chain, say a small fish, eats a substance, for instance microplastics, it stays in the organism's body. That substance might be passed to another organism, say a bigger fish, who eats the first fish. The bigger fish needs to eat multiple small fish to have enough food to survive, so that big fish will have more and more microplastics in them if all the small fish they eat have the same amount of plastic. If a human eats multiple big fish, then the human will have even more microplastics in them than the small or big fish. Many common everyday additives are labeled as hazardous by EU regulations. Bisphenol A, often shortened to BPA, and phthalates are added to plastics because they make the plastic less brittle, more flexible, and softer. They are also endocrine disruptors if inhaled or eaten. Endocrine disruptors can cause a lot of damage to the body. Some mimic hormones, some block hormones from working, and others can cause the endocrine system to overproduce or underproduce hormones. Hormones regulate many bodily processes, such as body growth, energy levels, the function of reproductive organs, and blood sugar control. Other chemical additives include heavy metals. They have a relatively high atomic mass and relatively high density when compared to water. Some examples are aluminum, zinc, copper, and lead. They have various benefits when added to plastics: adding pigment, softening and making plastic more flexible, acting as biocides. This means that they kill organisms to make the plastic more sterile. However, they have some dangerous health effects. Some are linked to breast cancer, anemia, hypertension, miscarriages, disruption of nervous systems, brain damage, infertility, oxidative stress, cell damage, and more. The toxicity of these chemicals, however, depends on a lot of factors, such as how the person is exposed to them, the concentrations or dosage, and the age, sex, and genetics of the person. Currently, studies about how microplastics affect human health are limited. To get to conclusions on what effects consuming or inhaling microplastics has on human health, many more studies need to be done. Studying microplastics gets really complicated really quick. This is because there are many different sizes, shapes, types, and additives, so it's hard to say that microplastics are dangerous for human health or microplastics are safe for human health as a broad statement for all microplastics. And as Dr. Myler mentioned, there has been a lack of long-term studies about animal and human health related to microplastics. Right now, there are many more questions than answers.
Yeah, thank you. I was actually going to ask you about that. I was going to ask, that was my next question, How do chemicals factor into the microplastic problem? And how do microplastics pick up chemicals and diseases? I think you did a really good job of addressing that. The only part in there that I think maybe you didn't mention was diseases.
Sure, so pathogens and things and you know, different types of bacteria and things can kind of hitch a ride as well on the plastics. The other thing I want to mention about that, I'm glad you asked that, is because the any surface in the water that water flows over can actually build up a biofilm on it. And a biofilm is just the matrix of a biological matrix that grows on the surface. And it's not inherently bad or anything like that. Oftentimes it actually provides a substrate or a surface for other organisms to grow on, right? So it provides like a living space almost, right? And so I've been working with some colleagues at Maryland Sea Grant up in Baltimore, and we've been looking at biofilms that are growing on discs that we put out in the water in the Patapsco in Baltimore Harbor. We're hoping to do that in National Harbor down here as well. And looking at seeing what grows on the discs, and that this has been an ongoing project that they've been working on for a long time for biodiversity on the discs. And I came into the project because I was really interested to see if microplastics were actually in integrated into the biofilms. And so in the Patapsco, we're actually seeing all sorts of organisms that grow on it that start, you know, different times and then build up over time. So you might start out with like a bacterial matrix, and then you have other organisms that start growing on it, like mud whipworms, polychaete worms, little mud crabs and things like that. And then you might have some barnacles, and then later some mussels start growing on it. Well, integrated into that biofilm and the surface, microplastics start actually showing up. We've seen little microfibers that the polychaete worms are actually using in their burrows. We've seen microplastics that get caught up in the Bissell threads of the mussels that are growing on the biofilms and or that are growing on the discs. And so this is really interesting, because it's not even just looking at whether or not the organisms are taking them up, but actually the interaction within their habitat of the microplastics as part of their habitat, which is whether it's intentional or unintentional. It can sometimes get caught up in the matrix itself and then get stuck there. And then the organisms come into contact with it. They might even use it as part of their, like with the mud whipworms that are actually working it into their burrows. So this coming back to the question that you were asking about disease, is that sometimes, you know, surfaces that water flows over, because it grows this biofilm on it, you can actually have other things that can build up on that as well, including some waterborne diseases and things that can travel in the water that way. And so, because I was mentioning before, explaining about the difference, with microplastics, the smaller they get, you have an increase in surface area. As you have that buildup of surface area, you have more area for the biofilms to grow. And then over time, you potentially could have other things that are that become part of that matrix, including potentially some waterborne diseases or pathogens as well. I have a colleague at University of Maryland that's studying just this topic, microplastics, and the interaction with biofilms.
What would you suggest people do to reduce microplastics? Do you suggest addressing plastic pollution in general, or microplastics directly, or both, but just sort of the distinction there?
So I think there's a lot of different things we can do. The number one thing that I kind of try to get people to think about, at least, is their use of single-use plastics. And that's not just, you know, plastic utensils that you get in a carryout, right? Like, yes, you should not be using them. You can find other things that you can use that are, you know, that are not single-use, right? But it's also things like, you know, small little packets of plastic, or the wrappers to, you know, granola bars or candy bars or chips or those kinds of things. All of those types of plastics, which we don't think of as actually being plastic, those are single-use plastics too. And they just end up either in the trash or in the recycling or in the environment. And even if they do go through recycling and the trash, it's really not the place for them, because the reality is that the plastics are not going to go away. They're not, there's, and those types of plastics cannot be recycled, right? Like the ones that I was talking about, those are more composites where you have like some metal and some plastic and sometimes even some paper all smushed together. You can't really do anything with those. So I would really encourage people to think about their use of single-use plastics. And if there is any option at all to turn it away, please just, you know, to think of you know, where that plastic is going to end up and whether or not you really need it. There are certainly, uses for plastic that we really need in the medical industry and, you know, in hospitals and tubing and like all sorts of different needs that we have for plastics. But we don't necessarily need the single-use plastic bottles or the single-use plastic bags or the wrappers and things. And so if there are ways to actually promote moving away from those, I think that's number one. That goes for individual choices, but also talking about it, advocating about it, talking to your family, your community, explaining why it's a problem, right? Like, I think that education is a big part of, that's why I'm involved with lots of organizations, because I think that talking about the problem is going to actually help to solve the problem too. The more people that care about it and do something about it, it certainly can come from the ground up. And also probably from the top down when we start thinking about regulations and policies that actually could make a difference. And there are a number of them that you can actually, you know, speak out about and chime in on. There are petitions out there trying to get plastics out of, decrease plastics out of food stores and, you know, plastic bag bans and plastic bottle bans. And those are all really important too, because the reality is when you go out and you do a cleanup, which is another way that you can actually help too, is to go out and do a cleanup, try to get some of the plastics out of the environment. Those are things that you see a lot of. You see a lot of plastic bottles and plastic bags and wrappers. And so those things are, because you see them in such high quantities and high volumes, that's what we're producing. That's what we're using. And so it doesn't just stay in, you know, in the environment that you go out and clean up. If you didn't clean that up, that would be carried down that tributary to the next bigger body of water, which then gets carried to the next bigger body of water. So it could start out in a creek in Montgomery County. It ends up eventually in the Potomac, and then it's going to end up in the Chesapeake Bay and then in the Atlantic Ocean. And then who knows where from there, right? And so it doesn't stop. You need to keep thinking about where it's going to end up and the long-term effects of these plastics.
Right. Thank you. So my last question, is there anything else you'd like to mention related to microplastics? So of course, it's a very general catch-all.
I think it's really important that people talk about it. So no, I want to see it more in the news and just plastics in general. And I know that, you know, one thing you were asking about was whether or not it was important to think about microplastics or macroplastics. And I think it's all important. As far as solving the problem, the majority of the microplastics that we're seeing originated as macroplastics. And so the fibers, especially thinking about the clothing choices that we have and synthetic fibers that we're finding in the environment, especially in the water, that it is just really high concentrations of microfibers that are shedding off of our clothes and ending up in our waterways. And so that's one thing that I think people don't talk as much about. They think about the plastic bottles and the plastic bags, which are big deals, but also the clothing that we wear, the fibers that are shedding off of them and are ending up in our waterways also. Most of those are making it through the wastewater treatment plants and out in the effluent and ending up in our waterways also.
Thank you for listening to Single-Use Plastics 101. The next episode will be about what you as an individual can do to prevent plastic pollution, specifically by addressing your use of single-use plastics.